And welcome to the Eastern Front. My name is Giselle Donnelly, and I'm a senior fellow at the American Enterprise Institute. I am joined by my colleagues,
Yulia Zsozsa with the Middle East Institute, Georgetown and George Washington University, and
Dali Bruhac, also with AEI.
On our podcast, we talk about the many challenges to European peace that have arisen along a line running from the Baltic to the Black Sea, the Eastern Front, and about why these matter to the United States. If you enjoy this episode, please consider subscribing, rating, and reviewing us on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcast. Thanks for joining us. Today, we're going to do a little theater before we start the discussion among the three of us, starting with the meeting between French President Macron, German Chancellor Scholz, and Polish President Donald Tusk a week or so ago, which has been hailed as an attempt to repair the Franco-German split over the war in Ukraine, does mark an increasing role, perhaps, for Poland in European security affairs, and looked at from America, is been taken as a manifestation of Europe thinking about maybe stepping up to the plate and playing a larger role in European security as concerns about American commitment to Europe fade and are called into question. So what we're going to do to start is do a little role play exercise. I'm going to play the part of Chancellor Scholz. Yulia is going to have fun channeling her inner Gaullist as President Macron, and Dalibor, as ever, relegated to the role of the Central European, but having possibly the most credibility of all of us, will channel his inner Donald Tusk. So this will only last a little while, and then we'll get down to a serious conversation. But role play exercises are good for empathizing and understanding the various perspectives that participants bring to international affairs. And so simply as a source of entertainment, we're going to try this on you. This is our most artisanal moment in 170 episodes, so please bear with us. So as Chancellor Scholz, I deem myself to be the senior statesman in this group. Everybody has always seen Germany as the most potential candidate to be the leader of a post-American Europe, if we can call it that. But like my predecessors in the chancellery, I'm of two minds, and actually I'm terrified of being thrust into this role. My country, Germany, has prospered by living in America's skirts for 75 years. We've transformed our society and our economy in a way that has allowed us to reclaim our self-esteem. Yet at the same time, our domestic politics are always a little bit, especially since reunification, have been a delicate balancing act. So I'm really nervous about President Macron's ambitions to assert European leadership. I think he's willing to spend the last Deutschmark or Euro and sacrifice other people's money and interests on the altar of Gaullism. We've seen this before. So as he's flip-flopped yet again on Ukraine and now decided that it's time to be martial and leaning forward and possibly even deploying Western European troops to Ukraine, it made me very nervous. So my attitude entering this conversation that we're going to have is one of extreme caution bordering on paranoia. So thank you for joining us. And President Macron, I turn the microphone over to you.
But Olaf, there is nothing to worry about. The truth is that France has always wanted to lead, and this is an opportunity to do so. France would argue that we have never changed our position that much. We try to prevent war by talking for many, many hours with Putin over the phone, and that has failed. And now the United States is nowhere in sight when it comes to leadership. We've seen the United States leading in the first year, but now Biden cannot even make his own Congress deliver the supplemental aid. And so this is an opportunity to lead. And I want to highlight one interesting thing about the economic aspect. Olaf, you have sort of undersold yourself because Germany is delivering enormous amounts of aid.
I've noticed that we're spending more money than you, my dear.
Yeah. But we're doing leadership on the cheap. And so that's quite interesting because France is not delivering anything close to Germany and I think is barely competing with Poland at this point, despite a completely different GDP per capita. But the move, first of all, of France, at least by words, to support membership in the EU and NATO, unlike Germany. Germany seems to be the power that stays reluctant now, including with the United States. And on the other hand, this idea of saying we have no red lines. That's how I read it, the true proposal. We have no red lines. And if I want to place French troops on the ground, then this might have a deterrent effect on, I'm hoping, as France, on Russia, even whether I place them or not. And it's also interesting because it completely destroys the German and a bit of currently the Biden narrative of nothing can be done because we're within NATO. And if we're within NATO, so we have to coordinate our action. And Macron is saying, no, if I want to send troops to Moldova or to Ukraine, I'm just going to do that. And I don't need the approval of so many member states. They might be very scandalized, but Olaf cannot prevent me from doing so. And so to me, it's an attempt to step in, to take advantage of a vacuum that the French are good at, to be taken more seriously, but without really putting, because that's the narrative that I hear from Germany. France is not putting a lot of money on the table. They're not trying to compete with Germany, let alone the United States, in delivering. They're saying we're going to do some kind of mishmash deterrence on the cheap. But in the absence of anything else, I think it's a more than welcome sign, isn't it?
Donald, he's trying to get us in World War III, or he's playing rather fast and loose with everybody else's security interests.
Before Donald speaks, I would like to remind Donald that Radek said that there are already troops on the ground.
How very typical that the Eastern European has been sitting here for 5 minutes listening to your babbling. But I have to give credit to Julia for actually getting into the role, because I don't think Giselle's opening was very effective. I mean, she basically read the stage instructions rather than perform the role.
And the self-undermining was quite strong. She cannot help her American psyche.
A couple of things from the Polish perspective. Obviously, Western Europe, including Germany and France, are not doing enough. It's not enough to give oneself the credit for being the largest contributor after the United States if, you know, you don't really have a clear strategy and an end goal in mind, and if you are not giving Ukrainians the resources that they need to actually defeat the Russians. Like, this is not a sort of exercise about being somewhere in the rankings and the reaching some absolute number. Like, you know, Germans have this habit of reducing things to sort of technocratic rule following exercises, and it strikes me that this idea, okay, here's a Kiel ranking and a Kiel Institute ranking, and we want to be ranked at a certain place. I think that to me is a sort of substitute for actually thinking in strategic terms about what's happening in Ukraine. And to give President Macron credit, I have to say, both, you know, speaking as myself and as a putative Donald Tusk, I mean, I do welcome the strategic initiative that has come from Paris, because I think for far too long, where collective West has been in a sort of reactive mode. You know, we are waiting for Putin to do things, and then we respond, and then we slap another wave of sanctions on Russia and so on and so forth. And so just floating this idea of NATO troops on the ground, I think, you know, kicks the ball into the other court for a bit. And I think that is in and by itself quite useful, regardless of what you think of the merits of the proposal. And I think more of that is needed. As Donald Tusk, obviously, I'd be very pleased to be back at the table. And as, you know, Dalibor Rohac, co-host of the Eastern Front podcast, I'm very glad that the Poles are back at the table. And I hope that going forward, Tusk and Macron will be able to somehow wrestle Mr. Scholz to do more, specifically on this issue of, you know, long-range artillery and on building real capacity that can sustain Ukraine, especially if US support is withdrawn.
In that vein, as we're turning back to Olaf, I also want to ask Scholz/Giselle in this instance, if Germany thinks we can continue with this without Germany's economy being switched a little bit to war footing to increase production, because we're talking about air defense systems, missiles, supplies running out. We're talking about ammunition running out. And it's really Germany's industrial base that we have to rely on. So, Scholz, over to you.
Well, I don't have a defense industrial base. That's the problem. Although I am definitely feeling the need to start planning for a two-front war again. Look, we have built the Federal Republic, so to speak, on the premise that we will remain a junior partner in whatever coalition is required for European security. So Donald is actually quite on target when he observes that German leadership is going to be very difficult for us, frankly, and it will require us to make much more. We have made a lot of economic sacrifices in terms of rejiggering our energy supply sources, and German industry, is broadly speaking, is facing huge challenges internationally. And maintaining social harmony inside Germany, especially these days, is a real challenge, which I wish you all would appreciate a little bit more than you seem to do. So asking me to play any sort of substitute role for the role that the United States has played through all these years, and around which we have built our model of prosperity, our model of peace, our model of security, and our model of domestic harmony, is a huge ask. Pity poor me.
So I guess this is our transition back to normality. The big question beyond this Weimar Triangle.
Also, if I may say, I resent Donald's implication that I am not channeling the true Germany, okay? I'm simply telling the truth.
You're recovering, no worries. Now we're all credible. But the big question that I think we're all trying to address here, whether we're focusing on these three countries primarily, but overall on transatlantic relations, is it's now becoming mainstream that Europe needs to be getting ready for war, helping Ukraine, but also getting ready for war. And it's worth assessing March 2024, over 2 years into the full-scale invasion, where people are mentally. Because I see on the eastern flank, some countries seriously getting ready for war, some others not at all, or some pretending to, but they're not. And to me, the change in France's rhetoric in admitting that war could be coming all the way to the West is quite a big deal, which then should enable others to start taking this more seriously, investing more into it, etc. And I'm wondering how both of you feel about this. I'll just add one more thing here to reconfirm our assessment that people are not getting ready enough. But nevertheless, we've had 2 weeks ago the first defense industrial military strategy of the European Union, and it looked amazing on paper, but it only puts together 1.5 billion euros. That's like nothing. That's what we used to send Ukraine per month, right? And the French commissioner has proposed this to be at least 100 billion euros, but we don't see any movement towards that, though, you know, more and more statements coming out of Brussels that this is taken increasingly seriously. So can we, as we're looking at the situation on the front line, can we assess that as elections are getting closer in the United States, Europeans will qualitatively, some of them, make a shift? Or is it that at the end of the year, no one's going to be more ready than they are now?
I fear that the dominant sentiment across Europe is still complacency. Like, you know, it's been a perennial question since we started the podcast. Like, you know, is the glass half full, half empty? You know, like, people have stepped up, but it's like nowhere near where it should be. And actually, like, if anything, I would give Macron credit these days for, you know, banging the drum on this and trying to really create a sense of urgency. Like, you know, like, we take it for granted that, okay, front lines won't move much this year, but like, things can take a really bad turn. If people run out of bullets, like what do they do? Like, nobody expected Russians to be routed out of Kharkiv. Like, you can have similar situations occurring in the other direction as well. And like, what would we do if you had suddenly, you know, Russians like bordering with Transnistria, right? Like you could have real pockets of like instability, like threatening Europe in a way that would sort of make the current war seem relatively small. So I just don't see people sort of reckoning with this fact, including in Eastern Europe. So yeah, Slovakia is holding presidential election on the 23rd and then a runoff on the 6th of April. Two of the candidates who are, you know, marginal figures, but like they said that their favorite statesman in the world was Alexander Lukashenko. You know, there was a 2023 poll on which 69% of Slovaks blamed the war on Ukraine and or
when
the West.
This?
Last year. And this is Ukraine's neighbor, as is Hungary. So I don't know. Like, I feel that like things need to get worse for people to sort of wake up to this reality. And maybe, I mean, I'm, you know, praying in my sort of own agnostic way for the supplemental to get through Congress. But like maybe it will take, you know, something really bad withdrawal of American assistance for Europeans to realize what they are dealing with. Again, like the sort of the magnitude of the European response is telling. Yeah, so we are talking about like, you know, 1 billion here, 2 billion there. Now the council is moving to use the revenue from frozen Russian assets to help fund aid for Ukraine. But it's just like, just the sort of scale of this is just completely off relative to the task at hand. And, you know, like when COVID hit, again, like I've said this a million times, like Europe was able to suddenly agree on this recovery resilience facility, you know, 750 billion euros to be spent. Europe can spend on both sides of the Atlantic, right? Like we've spent trillions on things that people have only a vague understanding of, like, you know, what sort of policy goals they're going to achieve. And here, that's the main role of the state, right? Is to sort of provide for security and defense. And somehow it's difficult to pull it off. I just don't understand it.
It seems to me the explanation is that, as you sort of said, and I think John McCain was famous for saying, things are always darkest before they turn totally black. The presumption of peace and prosperity is so deep. And this, I would include the United States in this. I mean, it's really hard to measure any change that the Biden administration or the United States has made over the last 2 years that corresponds to the change situation. Boy, not only in Ukraine, but around the planet, in terms of shifting social or economic resources, societal resources, back to the point where we don't take security for granted. We understand that we have to earn it and pay for it and stuff like that, with actually the possible exception of Poland and now the Nordic states and the Baltic states, which had never believed that their security was guaranteed previously. So the only way that I can explain this disconnect is, you know, by a broader societal or political mindset is not up to the moment. What greater external shock can one Pearl Harbor like attack can one imagine than what we've seen over the last couple of years?
As presume people don't realize that it's not just Ukraine. I mean, there is, I think, like I had a conception of a sort of global order that was reasonably peaceful for the most part, where there was freedom of navigation, where, you know, there were some predictable features of the existence that we were living in, and just like it's disintegrating in real time. I mean, like what happened with Houthi pirates? Right, so now we've sort of accepted tacitly that, okay, like shipping containers won't be able to get through the Red Sea. Essentially, like, okay, so is this the world we are going to live in? That you can't suddenly like use one of the major sea lanes? But it's almost as if the public has sort of like tacitly acknowledged that this is the reality and that's how it's going to be. And then, like, you know, when China takes over Taiwan, is that going to trigger a different reaction? Like, are we going to go gung-ho to fight the Chinese over, you know, an island on the other side of the world? Of course not. And so at the end of this pathway, like, there is a world in which the collective West, America, has far less power, and a world that is far more dangerous for everybody involved.
So then are we, next question, are we reaching a point where, I know that both of you and I and many in our bubbles are fighting against that, but for the mainstream, are we now reaching a point, or have we already reached a point where the assumption is that the United States is withdrawing? Under Biden, under Trump, this year, next year, I've started hearing this in an uncritical way as an assumption when questions are being asked on, apropos, because we're going back to Weimar, Deutsche Welle or France 24 or BBC. You know, the question is about whatever happens in Ukraine or on the eastern flank or whatever. And then part of the question is, now that the United States is withdrawing from the world, are we doing this or that? So to my understanding, this was not the case 6 months ago, but is it now that due to the Trumpists and due to Biden's fear of escalation in this combination, we're now looking at a 2024 and a 2025 and beyond in which the United States, no matter how many fires are being lit by Iran, Russia, and China, we're now at number two. There could be a number three, as Dalibor was just saying, or I guess with the Houthis were three and it could be a number four. No matter how many fires are being lit, the United States is going to play a very restrained role, and the rest of the free world is going to do what it does without the United States, which is fumble about and wait for the next bad thing to happen. Is that what we're looking at? Is that now a given?
Well, I think it's a description of reality, right? Like, it's not even an assumption. Like, that's what's happening. It can change, but that's where we are at the moment, I fear.
I would say that the behavior of the United States and liberal international order in particular in the Middle East over the last 20 years is sort of a precursor to now what we're seeing in Europe, where defeat was snatched from the jaws of victory. And in that case, the scale of destruction does not approach, you know, it would, again, unless you're looking at the work that the Russians have done in Syria and places like that, there's nothing that approaches, you know, a Mariupol level of devastation or the practices of the Russian military and the Russian government in, you know, genocidal behavior. So this is, it's not a perfect repeat, but neither is it a perfectly new pattern of events. And if you project it into an American / allied Western response to a serious crisis that involves a shooting war, the threat of a large shooting war in East Asia, boy, you have to be a little nervous about what the response would be. This is not our first warning.
Yeah, and we keep asking on this podcast, okay, is this the wake-up call, right? Is it like, you know, is it when things finally have started shifting? But none of what we've seen over the past 2 years, I think, amounts to a substantive change in posture. It just doesn't.
Why don't we return to the question of whether the Europeans can fend for themselves, or what would have to happen in order for the Europeans to fend for themselves? Again, I take a little bit of a precedent from the Middle East, in that the so-called Abraham Accords were seen as, among other things, not just a normalization of relations between Israel and Gulf Arab states, but as the foundation for an Iran containment coalition. And what we've seen over the last couple of years is that's been fairly devastatingly, but at a low strategic cost, derailed by Hamas, their Iranian sponsors, and so on and so forth. So the prospect for a sustainable Middle East order, absent a powerful United States, or again, free world role in securing it, looked a little tipsy, put it mildly. So again, I would approach the question of a self-sustaining European structure with the skepticism informed by that.
You know, this is obviously a realm of sort of fantasy and speculation, but I suppose the basic fact is that Russia's economy is the size of Italy's, right? And whether it's the United States or a consortium of European powers, they neither should have much of a problem just squashing Putin and his imperialist ambitions like a bug. We just decided not to do that. I would hope that as his imperialist ambitions grow, you will see a sort of coalition of European countries that are concerned directly, you know, just stepping up the efforts to deter Russia. But it's just, you know, how bad things will get in the meantime is difficult to predict. To me, I think it's kind of useful to think in terms that move past beyond the sort of reference frames of the past, such as, you know, I love the European Union, but, like, you know, the EU was not designed to sort of deal with situations like these. And people who sort of go back to, you know, sort of European Council and try to hammer down some kind of lowest common denominator deal to which Mr. Orban and Fico would agree, I think I'm not really doing a very useful service for Europe's security. And I think there has to be a sort of ad hoc coalition of countries, you know, from Finland, Sweden, through the Balts to the sort of Eastern Europeans who feel threatened by Russia that have to sort of lead and just do things without asking for everybody else's permission.
Yeah, I think, and this goes back to the value that I see in Macron's statement, no matter whether you agree agree that troops on the ground would make a difference. And it's so much of a discussion where you place them, what kind of a mandate, how many, the reality that perhaps, as Radek Sikorsky was too fast to mention, there are already special troops on the ground and it doesn't really make a difference. But it's creating, like Dalibor, you said, a different narrative about dealing with the war that for sure imposes a little bit more respect in the Kremlin than what we're doing right now. It cannot even, no matter how much goodwill you have towards the European Union, you have trouble taking them seriously if you're trying to fight a war against them. But the practical question that I have is, okay, so some are getting ready for war, some aren't. And so maybe this is how a coalition will form, and maybe the hundreds of billions of euros can only be implemented once Europeans start dying, like we saw with COVID in the early days. Maybe that's what it takes, and it will still be better than World War I and World War II, but we're not as evolved as a Western civilization to be strategically coordinating with prevention. The problem that I have is that if the front line does move, if things take a bad turn with a Russian surge and with lack of aid from either side, because one is unwilling and the other one is unable, with that in mind, what will happen if the front line breaks or just collapses is that in the first instance, what will happen until the end of the year then, or into around US elections into the next year, is another wave of refugees, maybe double the size, depending on how bad things get, maybe double the size from what we've seen. Already, the European Union has had obvious trouble incorporating and integrating millions of Ukrainians. And while I see countries getting ready for war in the sense of increasing military aid and military readiness, I don't see governments getting ready for that in either way. I don't think we'll look at the scenario in which countries, all countries will close their border. But for instance, Poland, that has been amazing, by the way, in the first wave when it comes to refugees, now I don't see the Polish government being active enough against propaganda manipulated transporters and protesters against Ukrainian grain or you name it. I see increasing reports from Ukrainians that they don't feel welcome in Poland. And so is Poland getting ready to take another 2 million in? Is Romania getting ready to take anybody in? I don't see that at all happening. Slovakia and Hungary seem to be out of the question. And of course, they will not stay in Poland. They will not stay in Romania. Is the European Union getting ready for this? Because that seems to be the natural step in repeat from what we've already seen should the front line move significantly or collapse. As we speak, villages and hundreds of people are being already evacuated. And so that's part of warfare and I guess preparation too. I just don't see the Europeans even envisioning something that they had to go through just 2 years ago.
That's the thing. So you, the risk of sort of contradicting what I said earlier, it is an assumption to sort of state that if things take a bad turn, that will make people sort of sprint to action. It can also be the exact opposite. And in countries where there is already this sort of narrative that posits that aid to Ukraine is not solving any problems, and that instead of supplying weapons, we should be urging peace talks. If things go downhill for the Ukrainians, you know, these sort of Babiš, Fico, Orbán-like voices will feel vindicated. They say, look, we told you. There was no way Ukrainians were going to prevail on the battlefield. And I think even people who sort of know better, you know, the sort of Olaf Scholzes of the world might go along trying to put pressure on the Ukrainians to negotiate, which would be tantamount to, you know, I suppose, capitulation.
Yeah, capitulation, because Putin has no reason, even more now than last year, to sit at any negotiating table, right?
Which is, again, like I'm going to praise Macron again. The way he framed this question of negotiations, I think is useful. And I think it's useful not because he's, you know, a sort of genius figure, but because Europeans just lost the habit of thinking about it in those terms, which is that we need Ukraine to do well on the battlefield so that they have a strong hand if and when they choose to negotiate. It's not like people almost work from the assumption that like war is somehow an error in the programming sort of language and we have to correct for it and go back to the negotiating table. And oh, like it's 21st century, like we don't do things this way. But it's, you know, it's a sort of continuation of politics, and there's a continuum from from sort of fighting towards negotiating, and like, you know, the realities that prevail on the battlefield are then reflected in those negotiations. Like, we can't really sort of shed the responsibility for what happens on the battlefield, because it's going to bite us in the butt at the negotiating table eventually. And it's like, people don't even think in those terms anymore in Europe, outside of a few places. And I mean, I hope that just more attention were paid to the sort of real world political consequences of a potential Ukrainian failure.
Okay, I have, in order to get us out of the hole that we've dug for ourselves over the last 40 minutes, I propose we turn to the world of role play and fantasy in this regard, that let's assume that there is actually a seriousness of purpose that descends like a mushroom cloud over Europe, and we get serious about it. I'm happy to kick this off, but I can't do it as Olaf Scholz. So unfortunately, I have to announce that there's been a fire at Bundestag, and Boris Pistorius, the defense minister, is now running the show in Berlin. Okay.
All hail Germany now.
I understand that, and actually this is an appeal to the two of you as well, that none of us can be the central figure, neither ourselves individually or our countries. And secondly, that the mechanism has to be NATO. We need to leave the door open for America to come back and try to incentivize them to play the role that we need them to play, especially because time is a fact. So what we have to do is agree on how to sublimate our three individual national interests. Find a candidate who's not German, not Polish, not French, but maybe, you know, Nordic or Baltic or something. You know, maybe Kaja Kallas will help us out here, or somebody like that who will be a unifying figure, somebody who will express our security needs and our liberal ambitions and be a pole of attraction rather than competition, both within Europe, that everybody can rally around, that will motivate as many of our neighbors as is possible, and will incentivize the United States to do the right thing as well. So I propose that in my role as Boris Pistorius as a proposition for the two of you. And just as my dear departed colleague, Chancellor Scholz, has decided to step aside or been forced to step aside or whatever, wondering whether you can contribute to that sort of a project. President Macron, this is a big ask for you, I understand.
Yeah, I'm afraid we have trouble with this because France likes the limelight.
We'll give you your own show in prime time, okay?
That's different. There's also now trying to put myself seriously into French shoes with the whole 180 degrees of a change that they're denying. The problem indeed is that France is the only one in continental Europe that is a nuclear power. A modest one whatsoever, but I think the only reason, going back to realpolitik, the only reason that France can make statements such as, of course, if we want, we're going to put in troops, and no, it's not going to be 2,000, it's going to be 20 or 60,000 if we want, and of course, we're leading battle groups in Romania and are in Armenia and trying to encircle in a very modest way, but nevertheless, Russia strategically. We can only do that because we have nuclear weapons. If I'm Kaja Kallas and I'm putting troops or threatening to put troops on the ground in Ukraine, Putin will be like, oh, that's great. Then I can kill more Estonians faster than if I were to go directly for the country. And so there's that too. It's not just, of course, Europeans would love to rally around one figure, but Kaja Kallas is too controversial. Our audience already knows that, what the German reluctance is, and you name it, the whole story. But the problem is also that individual powers, except for France and the UK, have no credibility when it comes to leading such a coalition. One needs, ideally, the United States, and the second best option is France. But France, everybody knows, including France, admits that it's a tenth of the power that the United States can project.
I'm not sure the answer really is in trying to sort of identify a figure or a country that can sort of lead the way. I think this will be, like, you know, assuming that the US stays out, like, it's going to be a messy process of sort of ad hoc coalitions, ad hoc initiatives. That's, you know, for better and for worse. I mean, we've seen people actually, you know, defer to the ceremonial president of the Czech Republic, Petr Pavel, when he had, you know, a brilliant idea on how to provide ammunition rounds to Ukraine. So you can have sort of, you know, small countries and leaders with relatively limited political mandates step up and have, you know, others listen to them. Obviously, there are limits to that. But I don't think the answer will come in the form of sort of identifying a particular somebody whom everybody will listen to at all times. I mean, it's very hard to do that in the European context, you know, other than having a sort of, you know, German or French hegemony over the continent, which is unlikely. From a Polish perspective, there is a difficult history with Germany, and no matter how much the current government is trying to improve the relations with Germany, I think it's always going to be difficult. There's always going to be baggage. And also, you know, there was one instance in the past when the Poles did try to sort of entrust their future and their sovereignty to the hands of the French, like in the Napoleonic Wars. The French didn't exactly deliver. I mean, the sort of sense that the power, which is, you know, relatively far away, will somehow, like, run to their rescue when things go badly, I think that it will be always treated with a bit of suspicion. And that's true of the United States as well. But, you know, there is the Polish community and there are precedents of Americans coming to the rescue in the past. So from a Polish perspective, I think, you know, there'll be every incentive, regardless of who's in the White House, of leaving the door open for Americans to come back, as there is no European substitute for that leadership. I mean, you could also add UK to the mix, which we sort of didn't mention. I mean, the problem in the UK is that, I mean, they are kind of useless when it comes to defense matters as of late, and the sort of, you know, gradual gutting of British defenses is likely to continue after the next election. Again, unless something bad, really bad happens in Europe that sort of reverses that. But I've seen a few signs of it.
Well, I propose that we exhume one of the Pitts to be the coalition leader. Yes, there's several decades of long struggle for peace and anti-hegemony in Europe. But I will just wrap this up by giving more thanks than ever to our listeners for indulging us here on the Eastern Front. All we hope is that our little fantasy session was illuminating. And actually, I think we ended up pointing out a number of difficulties and problems that are inherent in European security. So I hope it was useful to people. Our podcast is dedicated to these security challenges that have arisen along the line from the Baltic to the Black Sea. If you enjoyed this craziness, you can find more episodes and additional content on our website at aei.org, on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts. Please be in touch with us on X, the artist formerly known as Twitter, using the hashtag Eastern Front Pod, written as one word. You will find other delights, including links to our newsletter, in the show notes. And if you did enjoy this episode, against all likelihood, please consider subscribing, rating, and reviewing us. Thanks so much, and goodbye.